Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do. From Namibia, Africa, and around the world, tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Good afternoon and welcome to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. And as always, this time of the day from 4 to 6 is your favorite duo here on Eagle FM. That's Helmut and Dwight with Home Run keeping you company while you prepare to leave, or if you just walked in your office, if you're one of, you're the boss, you're just walking in to look around and you're listening to Eagle FM, thank you for tuning in. And if you're one of those employees that are just there, has your headphones on while you're busy because you want to be up to date with what's going on around the world, because you just love Eagle FM, you just can't put your headphones down or your phone down. But, wherever you're tuned in from, thank you for tuning in to Eagle FM at this time of the day. And as usual, we have, an exciting topic here, on Home Run with Helmut and Dwight. And today we're looking at, the African Union. And, it's the African Union. Of course, we're going to talk about money. And, we're going to talk about, financing of the African Union from the Kigali Declaration. So, the good thing of being a Kabango is I can repeat that over and over again. Kigali Declaration. I don't want to point any fingers, but I have a couple of friends who, if you told them that, you either have to say Kigali Declaration 5 times in a row or you go to jail. Eish, prisons will be full, you. But we're not here to sentence anyone. We are just here to talk about the African Union's Kigali Declaration. And that's because, this Kigali Declaration is coming out of the 27th African Union Summit. And that took place back in 2016. And that's where that was in, of course, Kigali, Rwanda. And if you don't know what the capital city of Rwanda is, especially if you don't know what the capital city of Namibia is, we are calling the Ministry of Home Affairs to look at your national documents, because clearly something is amiss. Now, here's the thing. In the A Kigali Declaration, they were basically acknowledging something that we all knew, or everyone in the African Union, or basically every African that is interested in the continent's world of continent's political affairs, knows that financing is a very big deal. Not just it's not just individual countries that are struggling with their respective finance their their national projects, but also financing on the African level. That's also, that's a big problem. So the Kigali Declaration that was that came out of the 2016 African Union Summit was referenced in the when they met this year in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. So just looking at how much progress are we making? Any progress? Now I checked, and from the look of things, they are going to meet again in June. I think that's where we're going to see straightforward, more like report on the progress that will be made in terms of of countries that are contributing their dues and those ones that are not contributing their dues in terms of running the organization as a whole. And this is an intergovernmental organization. It's made out of, I swear, 50 plus countries that are sitting on multiple natural resources. In other words, I don't even know why we pray for miracles on this continent, because we already have, like, at this point, God or Shiva or Vishnu, whoever is your preferred divine deity, is looking at Africa going, what do you guys want me to do? I gave you all the resources. It is right there. I mean, according to the pictures floating all over the internet of our Lord and Savior, he's white. Now, if you ask me, if Jesus really is white, then God really, really, really like black people. Because he decided to put us on a continent that has all the resources. And then took, well, his fellow people, white people, and put them in place with, well, not just zero resources, but it's also freezing cold. Just decided to pause because I, you know, could feel someone praying for me. Forgive this man. He knows not what he's doing. I just, believe me, I know what the African Union is all about. So, let's start with the Kigali Declaration, and then we can come, you know, from there to, you know, then we can come from there to the 2025, you know, discussion where it was brought up again to look at, what actually is going on in the world of financing. Now, all that is coming from a document that was mined by yours truly, Dwight Links. When it comes to information, oh, he's very good at hunting for it. So, the information that we are looking at is coming from just a series of decisions and declarations that were that was compiled by the African Union earlier this year when they met in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And part of the things that they reflected on is the Kigali Declaration, like I pointed out earlier, that was held back in 2016 in Kigali, Rwanda, which was heavily focused on the organization's independence in terms of financing. Because right now it's still heavily, even to this day, unfortunately, heavily reliant on non-membership funding. Hey, Dwight.
Hey, Helmut, and good afternoon to the listeners.
You know, from the hair, I can tell you're exhausted.
The hair is just all over the place. Don't worry about the hair, Helmut. It's about, you know, what's going on in the noggin, you know, here in the brain, here in the skull situation. But I wanted to say interesting times, but, you know, interesting times stay interesting times. That's as far as it can go. But yeah.
Is it me or we are just talking about money a little too much this week? I mean, we were talking about money yesterday, even though from a regulatory standpoint and also on a national level. And today we are looking at a continental level, like in Indonesia. Yeah.
Well, the money issue will always come up, Helmut, because here's the funny thing. Yeah. Earlier today, and this is obviously not in line with our topic, but slightly it leverages into it.
Yeah.
I heard from a panel discussion earlier today where a gentleman from the Ministry of Gender and Child Welfare highlighted that, you know, one of the most impactful thing is in terms of, you know, under this discussion of resilience because of a conflict somewhere in the Middle East around a little bit of a 28-kilometer wide gap in the sea, you know, between between one part of the Middle East and another part of the Middle East. Resilience starts becoming a song that vulnerable economies start singing.
Why though? I mean, we started talking about resilience when the COVID-19 was strangling our economy to death.
Exactly.
And then after that, we were like, what could go wrong again? And then the Strait of Hormuz pops up. And the discussion around resilience is, why does it always have to pop up when we're in the middle of a disaster?
Exactly, Hamoud. And some of the particular key concerns has been also, for example, did you budget for it? That's why I referenced back on Friday's discussion that, you know, how could our Minister of Finance, how could she possibly know that just the next day, the Saturday morning, no, not the next day, 2 days after her speech in the National Assembly on 20th, she provided us her budget in 26th February. How could she know on 28 February, the Saturday, that things would be going down literally in that strait, in that particular neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
And while her particular budget submission and also the subsequent debates around every particular budget allocation for every ministry and the ministry's particular various directorates which have concluded, I think, at the start of this month, because the whole of March was basically those debates, was a scenario of what are we, you know, how are we responding to this particular situation? Because the response, like you highlighted, was now, why are we using a term in a particular period? But before then, we couldn't, you know, just have resilience as sort of like the default system to fall back on. So, yes, Hamut, it is. You are right. We are talking just a little bit too much about the finance thing, which is good because money makes everything move. You know, you can't. You can't go anywhere without the money.
Mm-hmm.
The downside is, let's, for example, say you were reliant on an external funder for a specific program. What then? And you on 26 February said, we've got money to do this. And now suddenly you have to hear, yeah.
Some external factors you don't have control over.
Yeah. What was that favorite phrase you like saying? Well, you know about that money? You know, we're going to repurpose it somewhere. I'm sorry,
about
man.
That.
So probably, and that is my biggest fear, Hamut, that we might have to undergo that particular scenario.
Budget restructuring.
Once again. Which was a similar thing that happened also back at the start of last year. Remember with the USAID?
Oh, yeah. That.
Withdrawal by the United States and all the funding for 2026 withdrawal by the United States for most UN agencies. And, I mean, I still don't understand the particular perspective. Look, there's one interesting thing that I had a discussion with someone else about, but it was a discussion about how should we see the UN. Now, the perspective I was given, Helmut, was let's take a look at it, for example, like how Israel reacted to the UN. Apparently, and this has been very obvious, Israel views the UN as a hostile agency. Well, here's the thing. If you're the only nation that the other majority of... Okay, let's make it what? 30-something countries, almost 40 countries acknowledge Israel's existence, but the whole rest of the world don't acknowledge you.
Well, that's because people can read.
I think that's 150 countries that don't acknowledge you. Well, South Africa is dodgy because South Africa does have, I say South Africa is dodgy because South Africa does have an Israeli embassy in Pretoria.
Yeah.
The downside is just, South Africa is technically part of the cluster of 150 nations that does not recognize Israel.
Now,
even though they've got an Israeli embassy.
Now, look at it this way. Before 1979, before the Iranian Revolution, Israel, Iran, and South Africa were very cozy.
Mm.
Yeah, fast forward to 1917, because we are talking about the time of the Shah, and the Shah was obviously installed by the Western guys after the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh. And they were homies. Actually, it was the Israel and the US that helped Iran to, you know, set up their nuclear capabilities.
Yeah.
That they are now turning around, they want to, turn around to try to dismantle. So it will always boil down to who is in the executive office of that particular country. That dictates the relationship a lot. I mean, we saw just look at the relationship between the US and Russia, the US and China, for example. When Biden was in office, China was more friendly than, was more friendly in comparison to Russia.
Mm.
But now that Trump is in the White House, you have, the complete opposite. And so the same happened between, the ANC, or basically South Africa. Let's just go with the ANC because this was under apartheid. You know, this is the height of apartheid, South Africa in the 1970s. What you saw was that after the overthrow of the Shah in 1979, the relationship between Iran and South Africa changed from the Iranian government to the ANC instead of the Iranian government and South African government, or apartheid South Africa at the time, because the new government that came in after the overthrow of the Shah. they were more interested in South African independence. They were basically against the apartheid South Africa. And it's interesting to see that Iran haven't changed after that. They are still anti-apartheid.
Yeah.
To this day.
Yeah. So I know we went quickly into a geopolitical sort of like description right there, but you are right. I mean, for the past, since 2022, technically, wait. Let me be straightforward here. Technically, since 2020, the world has been in crisis mode.
Yeah.
So,
COVID-19. Oh, hey. Wait, 2019 for us.
For who? How?
Fish Road.
But that's not crisis mode, Helmut. That's just unveiling, things were dodgy, things were fishy.
People were shopping.
Shopping, for iPhones with dual SIM card functionality.
Yeah.
Which didn't exist. But yeah.
You can have it custom made.
You're still on that one.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll see. I would
still my favorite part is, keep your voice down.
Yeah.
Keep your voice down. You don't want the media to hear. The media was across the table with the camera.
They probably had it in like the salt shaker. They probably put it in the salt shakers. Just a point there.
Look, man, I think those guys were laughing the whole time they were editing those things for the documentary.
Yeah. So the particular scenario, getting back to on point where you highlighted, because you obviously left off at the Kigali
Declaration. Yeah.
What is surprising, Helmut, is primarily how we need to view the particular independence of the AU itself. Because it mentions right here that, okay, in the declarations and the resolutions and decisions document that you and I have, mm-hmm. which very oddly, the AU guys went and removed from their website. I'm still trying to understand why.
I like technology because it's still in my phone.
No, because I didn't know what I did.
Yeah.
I downloaded it that day, Helmut, because I knew it will not be there if I come back tomorrow. I downloaded it that day. So we sit with a whole document. What is this? 213 pages.
Yeah.
So we know, we can peruse through as much talking points and then we don't like what I continuously discover. Because now in the past 2 days, there've been like three continental discussions basically on key things. And an interesting one took place right now today. One about, guess what, Helmut Allah, our best conversation point, sustainable development goals.
Oh, boy.
It literally took place a little bit earlier today. At that stage, they were like at 4 hours of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at this particular scenario, yeah, they are highlighting primarily here that if I can call it a new period, because they had a period of 2024 to 2026 in terms of financial contributions of member nations, and that the new particular cycle probably has to kick in. In relation to the resilience comment that we had a little bit earlier, we have to start looking resilient ourselves, because we can't just be shouting and screaming resilience when a crisis situation happens.
Yeah.
Look, Helmut, here's the interesting thing, which boils down back to our discussion of the Italy-Africa summit.
Yeah.
The international relations or foreign relations plans that the rest of the world has for us Africans has been a discussion.
Oh, there's a France-Africa one coming in.
Of course.
Yeah.
I remember that one. There's a France-Africa discussion.
Yeah.
France is looking at scaling up mineral exploration in Namibia. France in Namibia. I'm not saying you might see French Foreign Legion, but that sometimes it doesn't sound nice. And then potentially sort of like the visibility that we've been seeing in our extractive industry taking place over the past 6 months. No? Four? Yeah, let's say 6 months so far. In the discussions, because Helmut, even though there's nothing new on the oil and gas, let me say it now categorically as well, and we still have to review the oil and gas summit that took place, the Namibian one that took place at the start of this month. technically, there's nothing new.
No, there's nothing new.
You know, in terms of either advancing what the baseline survey said or debunking the baseline survey, technically, there's nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
However, what is new has been the activities in Namibia in our extractive industry. That has been, you've seen steady scaling up of activities taking place. We just have to be on top of the ball in terms of developments. Now, here's the thing. Will this translate to Namibia having resilience? It would be nice to obviously highlight later in the conversation Namibia's contributions to the AU. But will it translate to our resilience? Will it make Namibia a little bit more directly involved in sectoral development? Because another thing also pops up, Helmut, in terms of how you become resilient, is if you are involved as a government in a sector. Not saying, we've got a policy, it's up to you, or you suspend a water act and then for 10 years you allow exploration on an aquifer to take place, and then suddenly when it becomes 2021, 10 years later,
you know what?
We've got this wonderful act. We have to withdraw your license. But everything else is in order. It's just this one license that is an issue. So
yeah, but that's the license I need to go in operation mode.
Exactly. That's the key license. So the other licenses are saying, yeah, you everything looks above board, my guy. But the one itsy-bitsy little license that helps you actually just cross the line into activity is the one that is hanging somewhere in the sky, not being resolved. So that is another resilience factor. On the aspect of AU contributions, well, you know what? I'd like us to tear down that AU building in Addis. And I'd like to see African architecture feature with African construction and build their own building. But here's the discussion. Must you tear down an old building and build a new one? While the current one doesn't, there's probably nothing wrong with it. I know I'm starting with a building.
Mm-hmm.
I know I am. But have you ever heard of your headquarters being donated to you? Let's just be honest, Hamut. Have we ever heard of this? Look, I'm a Catholic. I know most of the Catholic churches in this country were built on a European design. There's nothing I can do. It was also before my time. And in many scenarios now, the Catholic Church, which is a part of the UN, the United Nations, is a nation state. Technically, every cathedral or every Catholic church or parish in this country is a embassy. So it technically is sovereign.
Territory.
Sovereign territory. So now we sit with a conundrum, Helmut. If you want to see what a community installation, which is very crucial in everyday community development, meaning a religious site or a religious building, which in many cases, in many countries around the world, sometimes a town or village is built around the church. That's how much of the layout looks like.
Yeah.
However, when we're now coming into this, I don't want to say neo-African perspective, we have to ask the question primarily, what is African architecture, African expression, specifically in construction, design, engineering, and all those manner of things? And contributions aside, we're not yet on the money. We're just in the developmental side of things. So yeah, it would be interesting who pitches in, you know, for building a new AU headquarters. Would it be Angola with a tier one status?
First of all, Africa is 50 plus countries.
Yeah, there's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Minus the ECOWAS dollars.
It's 50 plus countries.
Oh. What currency are they using?
Well, which is why we want to form, make our own currency, Moss. And sometimes you want to take things serious, but these guys are just not helping.
How are we collecting the contributions, the national contributions? And I suspect it's in US dollars.
There's a very nice map that I came across that has the African Union and the EU, you know, the African Union and the EU logo and, you know, GMES and Africa. Basically, it shows, it points at different countries that different African countries and the natural resources present in these countries. Mm. Oh my God, this continent is rich.
No, we are. That's why I asked you.
On Namibia alone, because we are, well, we are in Namibia. So I'll just, zoom in on us. Every single dot you see is a specific natural resources. And you see that, those dots are very concentrated. The sites, or, you know, the sites of Zambia and, the sites of Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Eastern Botswana. And the dots that you see there is
I feel sorry for Botswana.
Now you have Africa has gold, iron, chromium, diamond, phosphate, copper, manganese, asbestos. I wouldn't recommend that. You have aluminium, lead, zinc, and you have some I have never heard of. Is it fluorspar?
Fluorspar is used in cement. We also have it.
The red dots, those are fluorspar. The blue ones, that's copper, which I think is an excellent color coding because when you expose copper to water, it turns bluish, and when you burn copper, it burns with a blue flame.
Mm.
Now we have graphite, lead, barite, again, you have, limestone, titanium, and zirconium, gold, you name it. It's a whole list. It's a very nice map that basically shows, that just the natural resources wise, how rich Africa is. Now.
What's the matter, Hamud?
The matter is, you have a bunch of countries on this continent that have gold mines without a single gold reserve. And you have a bunch of countries in Europe without a single gold mine, but they have gold reserves.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not going to talk about Austria because we know how most of it came about. Switzerland. You know, Austria supplied the painter and Switzerland got the gold. And one thing that I'm not saying we should go the direction of painters and gold, you know, banking. It's just the usage of it. First of all, how are we planning on coming up with all the money that will develop the continent without having an honest natural resources discussion?
But the question is with who? Who are we having this conversation?
Us. Let's start with us. Because we are not having that discussion. Look, I know 5-10 years down the line, you are going to start, hearing, things about, things like neocolonialism, which I think it's a very, it's a discussion that is, it's a name that is just technically cooked up to justify someone's incompetency. If you look at the Lobito Corridor group, for example, no one came in guns blazing and brought that project. No, it was a proposal put forward and we signed.
Yeah.
No one is bulldozing you.
Everyone went and said, okay, yeah, no,
Good. I mean, it's a good idea.
The more, the merrier. And obviously, how it impacts the particular trade between the three countries. And then guess where they went? They firstly went and approached the EU and the US.
Yeah. And those two countries looked into their private sector which they empowered and said, you know what? There's an opportunity of a market somewhere there.
Yep.
You guys mind putting your money together to provide this service that we need? Because what they need is to get as much resources out of the country to, out of the continent for the, to make, well, final products out of it. And that's the primary reason behind the Lobito Corridor Group.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that when the project is up and running, we're going to start complaining. Ah, no, they are not offering this service. The project was not built with your service in mind. It was built with their service in mind. Because it was built, most importantly, with their money. If you want a project to cater for you, put your money together and build it yourself, for the love of God.
Helmut, I sent you the contributions list.
Oh, boy. Here we go. Now, before we get to the contribution, 2016. Isn't that like 10 years ago?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, 2016. 2016, this was during the, is it the 27th session of the AU. So they met, and one of the things they looked at is how can we decision on the outcome of the on the retreat of the heads of state. That's according to the by that 2016 document. That's the title. And ministers of foreign affairs and ministers of finances on the financing of the African Union.
Mm.
Yeah. Now they are now. Well, they just. They basically set the, set a goal for themselves. Basically ask themselves one question. How can we run our intergovernmental organization ourselves? So then they went into what they do best. We are all in Africa, so what we do best. Affirmation. Except there it says reaffirm. So it wasn't the first time. That's nice to know. Reaffirms, the African Union or the assembly, the gathering reaffirms its determination to ensure that the African Union is financed in a predictable, sustainable, equitable, and accountable manner with a full ownership of its member states. That was in 2016. How are we doing so far, Dwight? Where's that list?
Well, that was 2025. Three main countries were the issue in 2025. That was Sudan, Somalia, and Burundi. I don't know what was up with Burundi, but specifically Sudan and Somalia, you can obviously look at.
Totally understandable there.
The one was, beating itself up. The other one was like trying to understand, our growth pains for the first time being peaceful. In another consideration, if you go to 2026, the decisions document of that executive council of countries, is a little bit more expanded. That one is a 20 something page report. This one is a 128 page report of 2026.
Yeah.
Known as the decision on the reports of the subcommittees of the Permanent Representatives Committee. They highlighted here specifically that the provisions requesting the Permanent Representatives Committee, known as the PRC, with the support of the Commission to complete the review of the remaining entities and submit a report to the Executive Council. Now, this once again just shows, yes, I'm saying yes to doing a job. Yes, I'm doing that.
I'll do it.
Yeah, another one is that they obviously highlight a request, that's now point four, through the Subcommittee on the Structural Reforms to continue its work using a case-by-case approach, taking into account the specificities of each entity and to submit another report on outstanding elements of institutional reform. Now, in conjunction with the decision of member contributions, the next cycle, Helmut, is supposed to be 2027 to 2029.
Mm-hmm. One ran from 2024 to 2026. Yeah.
We're still in 2026.
Yeah.
So it's because what it highlights in the decision or the deck, that document, that first one we looked
and
at.
And that has a decisions, a declaration, cocktail report.
Yeah. That one, the cocktail. That one speaks of we still have to wait for June 2026 this mm-hmm. year for the next heads of state engagement to take place.
Yeah.
Whereas this particular decision, this particular document was literally on the 11th and the 12th of February as well. Because I think from the 13th, the heads of state had to meet. So this particular engagement literally took place two days before the heads of state actually showed up for their shindig, where the, you know, they had to go for the continental powwow and, you know, and peace signs, and I'm not saying other signs, but you know.
So as I suspected, this was a side.
This was a pre-side event before the main event.
So this was a starter before the.
Yeah, so this is where the ministers came to meet and talk about things. But mm-hmm. there were ministers also on this PRC, this Permanent Representatives Committee. And there were obviously reports from the subcommittees that had to come through. Now, if you scroll down a little bit lower on page 3 of that same document, not the document. Let me first send it to you. You'll see this particular guy. I'll quickly send it now to you, Almut. Sorry. So if you scroll down to page 3 of that same particular document, it states that on the joint sitting of the subcommittee on general supervision of budget, financial and administrative matters, and the technical experts of the committee of the 15 finance ministers. Now, remember, these 15 finance ministers, they have to meet, which you can also assume is like literally a rotation basis. So the committee here took note of the reports of the joint sitting of the PRC subcommittee on general supervision and coordination on budget and the 15 finance ministers. Mid-year performance report by the AU, the 2025 AU budget, that it expressed concern regarding the low execution rate of certain organs and offices, and recalls paragraph 88 of a decision of the previous year on budget performance. That's now heading over into page 4. The next sentence after that states that the committee also directs the organs and offices with execution rates below 50% to submit corrective action plans to the Permanent Representatives Committee through the GSCBFAM, long name, for consideration before the next ordinary session of the Executive Council in June. So even before they make a decision for 2027 to 2029's contribution time frame, even though Angola went and said, yes, we would like to remain our tier one status, this particular committee was already concerned with 2025's particular execution rate. Now, in that one sentence, it doesn't say, or those two sentences together, it doesn't say whether it was like spending your budgets or helping with development projects or, you know, how we understand how a budget works in Namibia. You've got the operational and the developmental budget. It doesn't outline these particular nuances. Another one, which is literally just point number 3 after it, or point 13, sorry, where the committee indicated that they direct strict adherence. Now, when someone uses the words strict adherence, stick to your budget. Yesterday, we spoke about budgets.
Which is why I say this week is a money week.
You know, when someone tells you stick to your budget, strict adherence to the implementation of paragraph 88, basically, of the decisions. So that was obviously of December, the last discussion they had, on the approval of supplementary budgets, meaning you said, I need this. And then later on in the year, you come back and say, I need some more to achieve this particular event. And notes further directs the Permanent Representatives Counts Committee through its relevant subcommittee to consider mid-year budget performance prior to the consideration of any supplementary budget proposals. So, yes, the AU discussion guys are considering acting like what you see in Namibia. You have a budget unveiling at the start of the year, and you have a mid-year budget
review
at the end of the year. But they want to make it in the middle of the year so that, you know, before things end in December 2026, you knew what was being asked extra.
I can only imagine the logistical nightmare of the execution to keep up with that time frame.
Yeah, I mean, Helmut, like you said, 54 countries. And we're not even talking here about, for example, like what the private sector on the African continent wants the African continent to do. Like the guy from the World Economic Forum, the guy from Old Mutual, who highlighted, they don't want to look at Africa as 54 independent markets. They want to see it as one market. The downside is for him to think that way, right? Isn't something that he, that even them in their own scenario in South Africa does between South Africa and Namibia, or South Africa and Botswana, or South Africa and Zimbabwe? Because when, yeah, if you think about marketing decisions, market segmentation, strategizing around what kind of products do you want to sell, decisions are made in South Africa. But the operations in Namibia are custom fit to a Namibian customer base.
Yeah.
The Namibian customer base, Helmut, is not the Angolan customer base. No. The Namibian customer base comes a little bit closer to the South African customer base. Then you've got the Namibian customer base is way different from the Kenyan customer base, because even though you might have two English-speaking markets, they're on two opposite ends of the African coast. They have access to two different parts of the global economy. They probably have slightly stronger presences in terms of international relations, presences in their economies. For example, we've got a strong EU presence, but when you go to Kenya, you'll have a strong British presence. And with us, British presence is like just in tourist, maybe tourist numbers or in other smaller nuanced scenarios. So what are we looking at? How can, you know, from a South African perspective, how can they view, try to view us as one massive market? It's up, it's their headache. It's not our headache.
Yeah.
However, when you come to the discussion of contributions, just think yourself in, Helmut. What projects are being achieved for the permanent representatives committee to cite? Listen, guys, let's be a little bit more structured before we continuously just do supplementary budgeting halfway through a year every time. Do you not know what programs, international relations events you've got to run? Or are we just, you know, finding our way every year as... What was that thing that, what was that one thing that the one phrase a colleague of mine or former boss of mine used, you know, oh, is this literally like gunshot? No, I think it's France. Yeah. Shotgun, you know, shotgun arrangements, you know, you stumble the day of an event. You have to find things that the minute before the time frame you've got to start things.
Yeah.
So are they doing shotgun planning, for example?
To answer that, we should go to number 16, please, on the same page.
So, coming through from that particular point, number 16, where they highlight in decisions, the committee emphasizes that future performance reports should include clear linkages between programmatic results, and budget utilization to strengthen accountability. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That means they don't know what they're using their money for.
Well, they say we need a strong linkage. That means whatever link we have right now is not strong enough, and therefore has issues basically bring about accountability. When was that? I think it was either 2023 or 2024 when we went through... I think it was a group of representatives from Uganda. I remember there was there South Africa, Tanzania. I'm not sure if that was an African Union gathering or a SADC gathering. But what they looked at was implementation. These are representative from different countries. When it comes to implementing accountability in terms of financing in your respective countries, what are some of your biggest hurdles that you are facing?
Yeah.
And Tanzania and Tanzania, but I'm not sure about Uganda, and also South Africa, yeah. Two of these three countries pointed out one of the reasons why we have a problem is through the reporting process, you have different people from different political parties, and some people are playing politics.
Oh, it was the Pan-African Parliament.
Oh, boy.
It was the one of 2024, I think, that we looked at. Because I don't think we looked at... Yeah, we didn't look at it in 2020. We tried in 2025, remember, because... The South Africans were trying to say, hey, listen, look at us, South Africa, as your preferred BRICS member to champion the AFCFTA into the rest. And I was like, what are these guys doing? They're hijacking the whole Pan-African engagement.
They're just marketing themselves. one of my favorite song from Culture Spear, and this is a cultural singing group coming out of Botswana, is a song by the title of Kudu. It basically tells a story of one guy who had a crush on a girl and then did not have the courage to ask her out, so he sent his friend. Bro went there and then submitted his own application form, and he was called for an interview and was given the job. If you get the thing is, he was trash talking his friend to this girl while he was trying to submit his own application forms. And one of the lies he was basically telling the girl was, that guy is, he's still waiting the bed at that age.
Mm.
Yeah. So, if you understand basic Tswana, it's a very funny song. It's a comedy slash music. So, the thing is, what South Africa here is doing is, they're just marketing themselves.
No, they are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing also with that World Economic Forum discussion, where obviously they had to bring along, South Africa or Africa's largest insurance company, position it there at Davos alongside another South African, who's in charge of the AFCFTA. And now the two South Africans are literally like,
you know what?
Bulldozing the whole African discussion.
Let's bring this thing home.
So the South Africans were literally, and look, you could see, from the Davos perspective, let me just get his name, because he's also, I almost said another name, but the AFCFTA is really trying to consolidate all economies into one. The downside is just, if you've got on a panel discussion two people from the same country, not that I'm saying that there might be conflict of interest, but two people from the same country, the one in charge of a Pan-African organization is trying to talk about Pan-African values and looking into potentials. Yeah, the guy's name is Wamkele Mene. So Mene was trying to sound as neutral as possible, as Pan-African as possible. However, the actual corporate, the executive right next to him.
The guy with the money.
Yeah. The guy with the means to make the money move in the continent. From the southern hemisphere heading upwards.
All the way north, yeah.
Was highlighting, listen, if my South African compatriot can literally look at the African continent, which the AFCFTA tries to look at it as one thing, then we can reach a lot of goals. Now, obviously, you're hearing private sector telling public sector, make it look like one market. Then many developmental goals can probably be achieved. But here's the thing, Helmut. Nigeria also has insurance companies. Kenya also has insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
The Egyptians also have insurance companies. The Moroccans also have it. Okay, I don't know what's going on in the middle here, but there's a lot of insurance depth for the same product.
No, from the look of things, the middle that needs insurance companies have...
Yeah. Have you heard the latest insurance trend in DRC?
What's that? From M23?
No, not specifically them, the opposites. that the next level of insurance is now training paramilitary to look after mines.
What the heck?
Exactly. And what's happening in Sudan with paramilitary versus the actual military? How do you go train the thugs to look after your investments?
Paramilitary protection?
Yeah, because...
And okay, look, this is the biggest problem I have now with a lot of these multinational companies, because especially those that are operating in regions like DRC.
Yeah.
Aren't those like if you look at the place that is basically conflict prone part of DRC, like the Katanga region, for example. You'd be like from my understanding of how multinationals cooperate. I'm asking myself. This is clearly an unsafe area to operate. Why do they have a setup here?
Yeah.
And
besides the blatant occupational health and safety.
Because that's a whole discussion on its own.
Yeah. The concerns start, they start flowing into other things, you know, like women and child endangerment or safety, environmental management.
Because you don't have countries officials. Take for example, if you have a bunch of paramilitary, and these are not the same as the Namibian Defense Force or the Namibian Police. This is just a bunch of guys that you gather together, you know, made them trigger happy, and then put them in protection of. How is the Ministry of Mines supposed to show up there for inspection?
Exactly. Or here's the worst case scenario. What you and I know from the DRC's issue is it's a whole bunch of youths that only knew violence. They didn't know any stability in their lives. Now they're being formally trained how to shoot straight.
And, okay, who are they going to be shooting?
I don't know. Maybe mine hijackers or mining raiders. I don't know what this...
Illegal miners.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Hamoud. What constitutes an illegal miner?
There's a lot of that happening. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that happening in places like DRC, where you can... I mean, you have a bunch of documentaries going, you know, all over the internet, where you're seeing locals basically going through piles. And we're talking about mountains of sand to find whatever precious natural resources was mined. And this is mostly done in more like a partially or completely abandoned mines.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously, they're doing this because there's a market available for that.
Yeah. Or they're trying to make money. This is the only thing they can know rather staying at school.
Yeah.
Which to them would be boring, which to them would be time wasting. It's usually a bunch of us of our gender, you know, men.
It's mostly, but
you'll never see old men there. The knees probably gave out. I mean, it's one of the first things I'm
first us, things to
for,
go
for our gender. So the concern, but it's a good thing you highlighted the illegal mining, Hamoud, because and that's the reason why I asked the question of what constitutes the illegal part. Is it illegal if, you know, if it was people from literally a marginalized background who don't have any access to opportunities? Their local government clearly is absent in providing opportunities and development. And the discussion now is, let's hire a bunch of guys that were fighting on the border, formalize them into some sort of a security force, and now position them to protect.
Actually,
those guys didn't go to school, so they can't read anything, not even a stop sign.
Right, that's if you ask me, as a nation's leader, that's the dumbest thing you can allow.
Exactly,
because all that army needs is just one overambitious leader, and they will be eyeing your office.
And have you realized, Hamoud, how many times? Do these junta and coup leaders, do you know that they sometimes also resemble some sort of a labor movement of sorts? They've got a flavor of unionism.
It's
never a general. It's always a colonel or a captain, a low-ranking, but it's, you know...
Ambitions.
It's a guy pretty close to the foot soldiers to communicate, not too high to be disconnected, but is sick and tired probably of the ego of his high-ups. It's always a guy. And then, because most... I mean, look at Gaddafi. Gaddafi was a captain or colonel.
I think he was a colonel.
He was a captain or a colonel. So he was pretty close to a brigade. Because a general has to manage a lot bigger. You know, he's got various colonels under him.
Yeah.
This guy from Traore from Burkina Faso, I think he was a captain or a colonel as well.
Yeah, I think he's captain.
So too with his buddies. The guy of Mali, which is now under strain because his minister of defense was assassinated on Sunday.
Yeah.
By guys on motorcycles and land cruisers.
Of course.
Yeah. Land cruisers are everywhere, bro.
Look, you can't blame the Japanese for building something. For them, they just made a workhorse.
And you know what's the worst part?
Yeah.
The motorcycles are also Japanese.
Yamaha? Of course. Don't blame the Japanese engineering.
The motorcycles are also Japanese.
Japanese engineering is top tier.
It operates in any desert conditions, it's there.
Look, wasn't for the Japanese...
Yeah.
Look, if
the economy wouldn't have moved, Helmut.
All you just have to do is leave all the manufacturing to the Japanese, and then you see the longevity in your products.
You can forget about buying something new. Those guys have got you sorted.
That brings to mind the story of Toshiba.
Yeah.
Oof, yeah. Toshiba is one company that was basically strangled out of the economy by competition. There's a very interesting story behind why, you know, Toshiba just went, you know, down under.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, wait. Yamaha have joined the chats?
It might be Yamaha. It might be Suzuki. Look, Helmut, it's a motorcycle man that you even see here now.
Yamaha, Suzuki.
All of them. Japan is a huge motorcycle industry.
Yeah.
Motorcycle driving industry. And when I was there in China, Helmut, 15-year-olds, 13-year-olds have got motorcycles. For just basic mobility, for you to drive from here where you stay, from here where you work, to Komasal every day.
So basically just get a scooter.
Why must you use a taxi? I'm sorry, cab drivers, and I'm sorry, you know, the other e-ride hailing guys. But why must you spend your money somewhere else, Helmut? If you can.
Rain?
It'll rain when it rains, but they wear literally it's like a plastic coat.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Even though I've unfortunately been caught out by the rain on a motorcycle myself, it feels like 1,000 bullets hitting you.
Oh yeah, because of the speed.
Your face can be covered, Helmut, with your helmet.
Yeah.
But the way those raindrops hit your arms.
Yeah.
Bruh, it's like ice. It's like bullet icicles being shot at you. So it was me, the guy on the KTM right next to me, and I suspected he came all the way from Northern Industrial.
Yeah.
Because I just came here from Windhoek West. And then there was a lady on a Harley Davidson.
Okay.
At that massive, this intersection literally where you've got Auswanplatz, the side of Southern Industrial that leads to Game and that other motor dealership where Roads Authority is on the corner.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're looking at
the side of, is it the side of MNZ?
No, you're still too far. MNZ is still down.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about this one here. You've got Auswanplatz, you've got Roads
Authority. Oh, yes, you have Roads Authority, that side of Nampos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on that intersection, so I'm now looking in the direction of let's just say UNAM's direction.
Yeah.
Heading the southwards bound.
Yeah.
So the three of us are now on our motorcycles right next to each other. I'm on my scooter. This guy's on his KTM. It's that massive motorcycle they use for rallies.
Yeah.
He's on his KTM, and the lady is on her Harley Davidson. All three of us are wearing white shirts. Coincidentally, there was no coordination. I don't know the people. But all of us are soaked because the rain felt like bullets. And it was a torture, Helmut. All the way home, it was a torture. And the downside is you have to make sure you don't make any sudden movements on a motorcycle in the rain. Because you might slip and fall.
Oh, it's slippery.
And the person behind you might just...
run you over.
Yeah. While you're on the floor.
Ooh.
So that was one of the other particular concerns as well. So, yeah. The Japanese are everywhere with the motorcycles. Obviously, the big markets in Asia signal towards the level of depth. Look, Helmut, we could have sorted out mobility in Namibia a long time ago if there was an appetite for diverse
modes of transport.
Yeah. I mean, we became used to the notion that to pay someone to take you somewhere. So why couldn't you just possibly, probably save up somehow to buy your own scooter? But then, is there business in selling scooters? I'm not talking about this thing that the kids use. You know, that thing that you stand on. Even though I saw a guy the other day, literally going up and down, I think it was this in this vicinity of
Clinton. Yeah, I've seen those. And every time I see that, I can't stop asking myself, how is that thing not a wheelchair?
But
it's basically electric. A chair with wheels.
But it's electric, that thing. The downside is, Helmut, you've got potholes and speed humps.
Speed humps. You.
So potholes and speed humps are a problem. Plus, Windhoek has got unnecessarily too many streets. I'm really sorry. But since the mobility conference that City of Windhoek held last year, I've really gone and like observed Windhoek.
Mm-hmm.
And I do this sometimes subconsciously. Either I'm frustrated by something or I observe something and I'm like, why did you do this? For example, Windhoek loves roundabouts. It's what we call a circle,
mm-hmm.
but it's a roundabout actually.
Yeah,
because a roundabout sends you in any direction you can choose. You don't have to make a U-turn. Do you know the dumbest Namibians I've seen in this world are Namibians that exit Marua Shopping Mall literally on that other street,
the do side of Centaurus.
Okay, Centaurus is not the one in front of Centaurus.
Yeah,
the one that. On the side that takes you to the Centaurus part, right in front. You know, as you turn off to Maru Mall,
yeah.
You follow that road and then it makes a bend and where you've got the roundabout at the top
yeah.
as you turn into the spa.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, there's an entrance here out of the parking at Maru Mall here, literally here,
mm-hmm.
as you're on that road. You have Namibians that don't want to go to the roundabout, turn around and come down, back down. You've got Namibians that literally want to risk driving over this pavement in front of them.
I've seen those ones right here, Nelson Mandela. Not Nelson Mandela. Yeah, both here, Nelson Mandela and Sam Nujoma, that side of here.
You know that, and they also don't know that they could literally just turn off here left, drive past us, and then turn around and turn right up the street here at the end of us. Come back and then, you know, find their way back if they wanted to U-turn.
No, for guys, especially for guys with, elevated cars. Nah, just no.
Yeah, it's always the guys with the elevated cars. But yeah, so, the
money.
The bigger concern, obviously, regarding the money discussion has been, let's, for example, say that the targeted interventions. So, the AU wants to see a linkage between the money that is budgeted for and the outcomes. So we're talking about key performance indicators. At the heart of this, in between, things happen and a supplementary budget is being requested.
Mm-hmm.
Now the AU guys are saying to the other AU guys, we want to see deliverables. Stop asking for money. Where are the deliverables? What are you doing? Now here's the concern. Né? We sometimes see weird things pop up on the African continent. Like, for example, the three misfits there in West Africa, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, who don't want anything to do with an AU discussion. But they do find themselves on the African continent, so I don't know if they're trying to be a Switzerland outside of the EU, but benefiting from the EU, because that's what Switzerland benefits from. They're literally in the middle of the EU, but mm-hmm. outside of the EU.
They're not a member.
But they do benefit from the EU. They do benefit, Helmut.
Trade-wise?
A lot of trade. And banking services as well. They facilitate banking between Italy, themselves in Italy, themselves in Germany, themselves in France, themselves in the Austrians. If you look at their immediate neighbors,
mm-hmm.
you will recognize how they benefit. And because Switzerland is literally, it's home to the largest section of the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
You have the Italian Alps, you've got the French Alps, you've got the Austrian Alps. The Germans don't have the Alps. But Switzerland obviously claims that mountain range, which is a mountain range also cited for its unique winter tourism, the skiing holidays,
yeah,
and the resorts there.
Don't ask how much.
Couple it obviously also up once again with banking services and logistics and travel. Switzerland just once again draws a lot of trade benefits from its main neighbors immediately, who are all in the EU.
Okay, but that makes Switzerland a very interesting phenomenon in terms of both a trade and the diplomatic relations in relations to the EU overall. They don't want to be a member of the trade organization, but they are somehow indirectly benefiting from it.
Yeah,
and if you look at Switzerland, they are the only country, at least I know of in the world, that practice something called direct democracy. Like those guys, you know how the head of ECN here is, it's called the chief, referenda and chief referenda and the electoral officer.
Yeah,
yeah. Now, a lot of us in Namibia, we just know the election part, but not a lot of people that know about the referendum. Now, the Swiss vote on everything.
Mm.
They conduct referendums on referenda on everything.
Mm.
Take for example, they say change in legislation. They do obviously what we do here. They do consultations. They move from one region to another, and I think their version of regions they're called, is it cantons or something, where they basically, they're basically explaining to people, this is a piece of legislation we want to change from this to this. And then the next round that goes in is to basically carry out the voting, where they do everything with paper ballots.
Yeah.
Yeah. So will you just come and basically hold an election? After the consultation, then there's election on whether or not we should change it. The whole thing is counted, and then it's made an overall, okay, you know what, this is what the people have decided. So even governance-wise, it's completely different from the, from the entire EU. Why they decided to take the, and they've been known to be neutral in most, if not all, conflicts taking place in that part of the world. And again, what you see there is why did they just wake up and decide to be that different? And it seems to be working for them. It seems to be working for them in terms of governance. It seems to be working for them in terms of trade relations.
Well, Hamoud, it's a thing. If you know what should be delivered or what you want to achieve, you've got to know how to approach, let's say, every citizen in a space. The reason why I highlighted the misfit scenario of West Africa and gave you the other indicator of what DRC now wants to try and do in terms of
a paramilitary
force, we see the wrong focuses being prioritized. So when I say focuses, basically you can see, okay, let's try looking after the mining sector by training, delinquents who didn't go to school in any scenario to literally protect. But the aim should have been, let's use that financing to send all these delinquent young men who unfortunately did not go to any school, did not have any formal education, because of the conflict that was going on in our country,
mm-hmm.
to go to school, to get trained. We repurpose those skills, not to be combat skills, but to rather being economic skills, and then repurpose them into a economic goal going ahead. Now, when such a scenario pops up, you yourself sometimes ask in a Southern African context, this is a fellow SADC member. having such particular ideas around what is national economic priorities. You get to another scenario where you wonder to yourself, is this to antagonize Rwanda? Because remember, Helmut, there was an accusation earlier this year after the supposed peace treaty was signed that the M23 guys went to one of the mines or three of the mines in the east of DRC when they crossed over into the border again. The accusation that people who knew what the actual motivation supposedly was is that the M23 guys were told to go to certain mines in the east of DRC.
Told?
Yeah, supposedly told to go to certain mines. When they got to certain mines, they confiscated certain things. Specifically, the resource being mined at the mine and the shipment of the resource to be redirected somewhere. Now, why I'm saying this is because I only watched one report where the person being interviewed is a DRC person from the rest of the country, not a local inhabitant of the zone there of North Kivu and South Kivu. Not someone from that locality. Someone who came from Kinshasa.
Halfway, and DRC is huge.
And the guy, guess where he's living, Helmut? Homeboy's living in, I think it was London at the time.
You see, this is where the whole
narratives,
the whole discussion on DRC. First of all, the regions that are the parts of DRC that are war torn, you'd think they are too war torn for everyone to be running a business. For some reason, the natural resources business is thriving. You can't tell me those private companies, you know, are not having a hand on all the chaos. Because, you know, that argument can easily be made. Take, for example, after 3 January, when Donald Trump gathered up all those oil executives, what did they tell him, especially the CEO of ExxonMobil? Are you kidding me? You just destabilized the country. That's a war-torn country. Can you imagine how crazy it would be to invest in a war-torn country? But for some reason, the natural resources investment in parts of DRC that are war-torn is just going interestingly well.
Yeah, that's the talking point that comes through from the earlier today's, the 12th African Sustainable Development Forum, where they had what's the guy from Open Society, Kagoro, the guy from Kenya, who literally said, the policymakers are trying to convince investors to invest in a country that's peaceful and stable. But there have been more investments going into a country that is war-torn and unstable. And still continuing further investments.
Nah.
So if an investor is literally taking a gamble to put money into a mining endeavor in a war zone.
In the middle of a war zone.
Then ask yourself the particular question. Why would they bother with a peaceful and stable scenario?
Exactly.
So, which once again boils down to the particular question of the deliverables that the Permanent Representatives Committee or Commission was asking. We've got to know what we've delivered. Because remember, Hamoud, all of this is part of the overall SDG game.
Yeah.
If you've got projects, where is the money? What is this money doing in each of these projects? How are you going to deliver?
Yeah, and on the AU level, I think that's because when it comes to information, we have recently, especially you, I, and our listeners, we have been spoiled by our government with regards to information that you know that they're feeding us. I mean, we have capital projects, you know, reports coming out.
Yeah,
these are the projects. This is how much money have been allocated from this year, from this financial to the year to this year to this financial per project. All that information is put out there, and of course there are shortfalls here and there, which leaves room for my humor, which I a brilliant idea, and also shows that you are not using, you know, world AI. Now, when it comes to, take for example, if I was to look for the same information on equivalent to the to Namibia's capital projects on the African continent coming out of the EU, not the EU, the AU, how would I go about looking at that information? How do you go about finding that information? Where do you find it? And what is the AU's equivalent of parliamentary or national council standing committee? think that's where the accountability discussion now comes in.
Generate reports so that we know, yeah. So we can track and monitor what is being done. But here's the thing, Hamud. We see on a micro level, Namibia, what our own standing oversight committees try to do.
Yeah.
In a certain, if you now, you know, if you try to measure between when an event happened and when this oversight committee now decides to step in, you get a sense also of why did we leave it so late? Or is this early enough? Case in point, the Omaheke uranium exploration activity.
2021.
So we were looking, yeah, not just 2021, Helmut. Since 2011 when they began, up to 2021, a whole 10 years. 3 years later, 2024, 2025, only then do we send an oversight committee.
Yeah.
Only then do we send an oversight committee to actually try and get the gist of something.
What's going on here?
What's going on? Other thing was Oshikate High Court engagement, which...
more than 5 months.
I mean, not just more than 5 months. Okay, not the door exactly. Not the door exactly. But
just the overall infrastructure
overall
being used, yeah, in the dispensation of justice in Namibia.
Yeah, because they were pulling a period from 2015 up to 2020, I think it was 2021, which makes things also a little bit weird because at that time there were different executive directors who were different accounting officers, basically. So the conversation then is also slightly derailed, not even nuanced. It's just derailed because you're not talking to the right person on why did you make certain decisions.
You are talking to the person who wasn't there when the decisions were made and implemented.
Yeah, exactly. And why are you not going after the person or calling the person forward who made or approved certain decisions before the person that you're currently talking to? So... we sit with such similar, with such particular scenarios of how do you get the best out of monitoring and evaluation? Because, Hamid, I'll tell you today, even under the scope of auditing in private companies, I've seen how when some, let's say, managers or supervisors or team members leave a company, you know, they either resign or retire or are fired or they seek other opportunities somewhere else or they get moved to a different department in the company. The auditors will never talk to that person. They will never ask that person, okay, why did you do this and not that? What is the standard operating procedure for your department? Do you still remember what you had to do here? Do you still remember what you had to do there? Was there any communication related to this particular activity? Yes or no? One thing that happened, Hamid, was, and this is just a basic example. So, in a private company, when the auditor of a private company comes through, the finance department has to do two particular roles. So, the finance department has to coordinate with the operations department to ask them, listen, go and take stock of all assets that the company owns, physical assets. I'm talking about like this table, these headphones,
the cars,
this microphone, computers, everything. And it gets like an asset number. Go take stock of all assets on the that the company owns, physical assets. And at a media company, things were going haywire. Why? For example, a computer is plugged out here and plugged in there. It's moved from its particular, you know, from its particular spot according to what IT had laid out in terms of how the computers should be laid out.
Mm-hmm.
Or a printer is moved from this corner to that corner without the knowledge of the operations department, stuff like that, you know. And then the auditors come through and ask, so Dwight, why did you move your computer screen from there, from that computer to that computer? Who did you ask? No, I asked my boss. Who did your boss ask? Oh, no, he just said yes. Why did your boss say yes? Does he have responsibility for assets in the company? No. Okay. So, again, why did you guys move this computer screen? It's a basic thing, Hamoud. It's a redundant question. It's a dumb thing to think about. But that's actually the level of thinking that is required of what that sentence said in that decisions of the AU. You've got to show outcomes or how you spent the money. Meaning, give us all your receipts that you spent the money on, your budgets. We got to know. Yes, we know your salary will be there. There's someone pushing the button here. But it's where you are spending the money that you're requesting in your budgeting annually. What are you doing out in the field? What does it look like? Where's it going? Who is it impacting? Who is it benefiting? Who is not benefiting from the money you are spending? These are pivotal questions. They sound pivotal. Don't worry. They're just straightforward things.
Look, man, I really want to feel pity for my continent.
Mm.
And which is why I pointed out earlier before you walked in here that I don't even know why we pray for miracles, because God somewhere, I'm pretty sure, is looking at us, you know, praying for miracles, and it's like, guys, I gave you the resources.
You are already
what
there.
What more do you want?
Well, you are already there.
I mean, you are standing on the resources and jumping for prayer. I like how you are using the water. I mean, I gave it to you guys to drink, but incorporating it in prayer, that's on you. But the thing is...
incorporating it into prayer.
Yeah, just throw it in prayer. Like olive oil, my favorite of olive, you know, cooking oil, I can't afford. Someone is using it in prayer. Actually, it's more beneficial if you eat it. That is sure. Just try it in prayer. Maybe it works. And believe me, if it worked, bankers would be using it.
Yeah.
But that's part of my problem when it comes to some of these things. But, you know, funding on the African continent, it's especially on the AU level, it's something that's going to be somewhat tricky, because we don't want to address the elephant in the room. Value addition. Mm. Now, there then comes a challenge that I think you point out several times. Before you just decide, okay, you know what, I'm going to have all these resources. I'll just keep it for my country. First, chances of you ending up in a conflict are very high, because all the resources that the African continent has, there are a lot of foreign companies that have invested over decades, millions if not billions of years in these resources. So they are not just going to pick up their bags and leave. I know I wouldn't, not after spending billions.
Mm.
Now, we even have a historical example of that. Iran is in conflict right now because their elected president tried the exact same thing in 1953. Now, look at Iran before 1953. I know what the constitution says. It's very important to be honest with ourselves and start looking at it, things from the money. BP. Or then Anglo-Iranian Oil spend billions to explore for the resources. They are, I think the guy's doing exploration where this close to giving up. Because, London was pouring in money. Their head office was pouring money from London. Then they realized, you know what, this is not gonna work. Just leave everything. And it wasn't until the end, that's when they realized, okay, you know what, there is the resources here. That's when they're like, okay, well, we have hit a jackpot. They set up the infrastructure, get the resources. A new guy comes into office, flips the script. Now you have to forget all the billions that you have put into exploration and building the infrastructure. Just pick up your stuff and leave. No one in their right mind would do that. Now you actually, to some degree, understand why the Anglo-Iranian Oil was like, huh, I must leave. And now the whole just pack your bags and leave. It's not just the Iranians. It's not just the Iranians. I would point fingers for that.
Mm.
It's also the British, because after they created that Anglo-Iranian Oil, beautiful name, they decided basically to hold 90% of the cake for themselves, which is what created the whole friction between them.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it was just a fair, you know, if it was just.
Why does it sound like Namibia?
Because it, not, what Namibia? It sounds like the whole Africa. Now.
It sounds like us.
Yeah. It sounds like the whole Africa. What creates, and this is the same, this is the same thing that, I think that was, in 2011. Basically, now, Arriva, the French, the French multinational was cooperating. I think that was in Niger. It was operating in Niger for a very, and
Barrick. Niger and Mali.
Niger and Mali, yeah, Mali. Barrick Gold is Canadian. They're also operating in this, uneven split is what mostly generate a lot of friction from, from the people on the ground, which raises up to opportunistic politicians, and then you end up someone using that as their campaign manifesto. Well, guess what? People are going to vote for them.
Yeah.
And when they do, when the majority swings in their direction, what happens is they win the election.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you now have this tension between that multinational and the existing government, which is why you have a lot of, allegations of political meddling, because a lot of multinational corporation knows that if a guy who is a pro-nationalization, and you have a lot of this in all, in all countries, you have, people that who you will describe as, with a socialist political and economic point of view all across, Africa's political spectrum. And they make these promises. If you vote me into office, I will nationalize natural resources. But let's face it. What happened to two countries that I know that did that? Make it three. Yeah, make it. Now you have Venezuela.
Mm.
Yeah. Hugo Chavez nationalized. What's one of the biggest claims that ConocoPhillips made? We invested a lot of money and technology in the exploration and setting up of this infrastructure. That's the argument they made with Exit.
And what happened? Now, please exit.
Yeah. Now, were they wrong with that argument?
No, they weren't.
No, they weren't. Which is why I'm a proponent of if you want to build infrastructure, fund it yourself. Because if you are not funding it yourself, when someone comes over and take a big chunk of the cake, don't complain. Why? Because, well, they paid the most.
Mm.
But you know what? We just want someone to come and finance everything, and then we'll just go and vote and kick them out. But look, you're just going to end up with armed guys at your doorstep every year.
Look, how much...
Unfortunately.
It is the ugly world that we live in.
Yeah.
Unless a sense of stability is being installed or comes about.
You just pointed out one of my new fear unlocked when you pointed out that point that was made by the gentleman from Kenya that, if investment in war-torn countries is going just fine, what makes you think that...
No, it's more than in a stable country.
It's more.
It's more. I'll send you the link later on tonight. And you can watch, but it was literally like at the 4-hour mark where he literally said where they were talking about what can be done. And he highlighted, well, I'm sitting with a whole bunch of ministers and all of you are talking about being stable.
Political stability.
Yeah. But the stability does not, your stability, he says, your stability is based upon a scenario where you're hoping the investor comes and does the work for you. But the investor is more interested in investing more in a war-torn country or in a country that's currently a conflict zone.
Why? Because you don't have to deal with all the, the legislations and basically guardrails that you find in a stable country.
Exactly. Or paying taxes.
Paying taxes and all those things, labor unions, and now you have to treat employees this year, you have to give them leave and all. In a war-torn country, you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, you're just like, here's your money, thank you. Can I get the thing? Thank you.
Yeah. Best case scenario, here's the money. Worst case scenario, ask for your money and I'll shoot you. And, who are you going to report it?
Or we don't answer the phone.
Yeah, we don't answer. No,
we will not fly to you, don't worry. It's an ugly situation.
Jeez. So there's more investment taking place in politically unstable countries than there. Oh.
In Africa.
Just in Africa.
Just in Africa. Like I said, this was based at earlier today's that it was the 12th or the 4th African Sustainable Development Forum. And because, you know, Africa always has these weird names for its forums. It's either 12th Forum on African Sustainable Development or the African 12th Sustainable Development Forum. And he pinpointed an exact fact, which is a reality that exists. That there are companies, private investors who have appetite to bypass and to work and operate within unstable areas of this world.
Because exploitation makes it easy to hoard the resources at a fraction of the what or the price that you would be paying if the country was stable.
Exactly, exactly. So, yeah, we've
and painfully, that's your tech industry, unfortunately, is heavily reliant on that.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a picture that looks as puzzling as it does.
So someone just woke up and decided, you know what, we're going to use private... You know, the reason why that raises a lot of questions is, first of all, if, take for example, like, you know, like the example that you just gave, DRC, or more like the whole word in the wind that, you know, they are planning on training, you know, well, paramilitary guys to guard the mines. Now, Africa is at the center of security discussion, how to make the continent more safer. You know, for the Africa Continental Free Trade Area and all those things, especially in terms of physical infrastructure. I'm supposed to negotiate with those guys.
But why are you negotiating with them?
Now, do you go through the government? Because the government should also be, should actually also fear for its life. Because if I was the president, the biggest question I'll ask myself is, okay, I don't think there's a president who is comfortable having an army they can't control within their borders. Because that's ripe for a hostile takeover. One wrong general in that army, you are looking at your government overthrow. The only way any normal person will say yes to such operations taking place in their country is if they have control over whoever is in charge of that army. Call it paramilitary. Maybe it's not legally connected to the country's, you know, established military groups, but you must have control over it somehow.
Yep. And the casing point that we have on the continent so far is still Sudan, because the Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary, was constituted by Omar al-Bashir, the former president of Sudan, and his best friend was the guy that was the leader of the Sudanese army itself. And when Omar al-Bashir was locked up, these two guys were the ones that decided to take power of the country. These two generals. And when the civilians asked these two generals, hey, listen, guys, we didn't go and capture al-Bashir just for the sake of the two of you sharing the country. We didn't do this for you. We wanted actual civilian governance. And then they go make a promise. Ah, don't worry, guys. You know, we'll hand over power. You know, when things stabilize.
That's what they all say.
When things look safe.
Yeah, let's face it, power is delicious, guys.
We believe that you are still too young to, you know, to actually know what true power is. And then they set a deadline. They say yes to the deadline. And when the deadline comes close, suddenly the Rapid Support Forces guy is like, but it was my chance to be president. What's wrong with you guys? I also want to be president. And then you have a Sudanese, you have a Sudanese civil war right now. That is where probably DRC will go to, Helmut, when they go through with that training of paramilitary. I would still have believed in... Put those guys back in school. Put them back in school. Or absorb them into the army. You put them in divisions of the army.
Mm-hmm.
Where they are actual adults who know you don't use guns on civilians. You use to protect. You don't use it to attack in your country. You use to protect and then they get in. They get trained that way. They have access to education. They have access to other particular, you know, governmental benefits. Instead of now training them to protect mines, you are so You are training a security force.
Okay, number one, thank you. That's the description.
You're training a security force that has a cowboy mentality to it. And I'm not talking about cowboys in the actual sense of them being glorified cattle herders. No, I'm talking about a cowboy as in the books that I read, gunslingers. These guys are going to be like, hey, look at me make a trick with my AK. Look at me. I can balance it on my toes. Look at me.
And fire multiple bullets in.
I can hit all targets at different locations. Look at me. That's what they're training.
First of all, if they go through, you know, if they go through with that, they will just confirm the suspicion that a lot of people, including yours truly here, have been having. And that's one, if you are a private company that's investing, or basically any company that's investing in a war-torn country, you know, you have figured out ways to get your return on investment.
Yeah.
Because armies are not cheap.
Nope.
Yeah, that's one. Two, you have just decided to take advantage of the chaos and get the resources at a fraction of the price, which is a painfully very human thing to do. Unfortunately. Now, the thing is, as a nation's leader, they will have to somehow figure out the way to make sure that they have a control of, you know, they have control of that paramilitary group.
Mm.
Second thing is, these resources that you're sacrificing your people to go and die for, who owns the company?
It's definitely not an African.
Exactly. It's like,
definitely
at this point, the question to ask is, are you that dumb? So you're willing to sacrifice your future generations, you know, a prime time for them to go to school and become these inventors. So you're just going to train them, give them guns to protect a resource. Like, how much are you getting at this point? That will be a very interesting question to, you know, to put forward. Because, first of all, there is no way on God's green earth are you doing it for free. Two, there is no way on God's green earth are you not aware what's going on. And so is the company. It's you and that multinational company know very well what's going on. The painful part is, as in every conflict, it's always the, you know, the ordinary people that are caught in crossfire.
Yeah.
Now, my interesting part is, now in terms of security, what would be the African Union's response, response to that? One of the reasons why the whole silencing of guns failed or fell on its face is because no one wants to admit just how cozy a lot of Central African governments are with multinational companies that are extracting these resources. We talk more about how people are caught in crossfire in terms of unstable the region is.
Yeah.
But let's just get to the root cause. And this will always take me to one scene. DRC, Rwanda negotiations in Washington. This whole time, we were all pointing chaos, you know, we're all pointing fingers at the chaos in the, you know, in the middle of, you know, in DRC that, I know this is an M23 problem. When that M23 problem is being negotiated, there are no M23 representatives. And they're like, huh.
That means somebody's got somebody.
One of you is M23 representative.
Somebody's on speed dial, you saw.
One of you has M23 on speed dial.
Somebody's on speed dial here.
Yeah, look, the painful picture that paints is we are literally watching our own people die so we can protect resources for a guy who is a shareholder who is probably sitting somewhere in Switzerland.
Or you make it even worse. Flip it on its head, Helmut. What happened in Madagascar? We don't have water and electricity. We are striking and demonstrating for services, access to services.
Mm-hmm.
And the army finds it the right at
opportunity, the, or like, you know,
to say, you know what, I believe we can be the best leaders of this country.
Yeah, oh, we can run this country.
To lead the Gen Zs. And then the poor president has to run away to a French island. And a colonel, once again, a colonel. No, it was a captain this time. A captain, once again. a low-ranking officer.
They were military guys.
Installs himself as president of Madagascar. Now, all SADC says was in that discussion we had at the end of last year, please, Madagascar, please go and have a democratic and a free and fair election to decide on new leadership. But we want stability. Just follow the process. Madagascar's president was sitting silently the whole time. Didn't say anything. Didn't say anything. Now, I don't, okay, they do have resources, obviously, Madagascar. They're, yeah, they're a pretty big island nation. The downside of what happened in Madagascar was,
mm-hmm,
this was basic local authority management, Helmut, which is the concern I have with Namibia. It's basic local authority management, Helmut. Helmut, dude, if you get yourself a motorcycle one day, you must first get your license, Helmut. But if you get a motorcycle one day, ride through, you know, do what Che Guevara did. Ride through many of Namibia's smaller towns. And just go and think to yourself, why is this town stuck in 1990? My tag phrase that I kept using since the start of this year.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have towns stuck in 1990? What are these local authorities doing? And then you hear of the bustling mining activity around those towns, but the town is not looking up anywhere. You know, it's not like it's building skyscrapers suddenly in the town center, new housing developments coming through for a posh new neighborhood of, you know, some high earning inhabitants. Zero balance of that sort, Helmut. But there's a mine somewhere in close proximity. Well, it's because the inhabitants of the town actually want to see said particular trickle-down economics actually trickling into the town. They want to see it. They want to see investments into infrastructure in the town. But no. The guys working at the mine are most probably Windhoek residents. You know, they're renting only in the town closest to that mine, but they're from Windhoek, or they're from the coast, or they were flown in from wherever. They live literally on the mine. They don't want to live in the town. If they do live in the town, they rent whatever place they rent. So there's no actual investment and no actual anchoring taking place of investments into the town. But that is exactly the conversation, Helmut. If things can literally flip on its head like Madagascar,
mm-hmm,
nah. Places, unfortunately, like Namibia's, the rest of Namibia's towns, they are starting to illustrate such a lack of investment scenario. They literally, I'm not saying, or I'm knocking on wood, guys, I don't want to see anything bad happen to my country. But, I mean, if you can see a bunch of Gen Zs in Madagascar demonstrate about water and electricity, access to water and electricity, we've got a big problem. We've got a big problem of service delivery in this country. So yeah, I mean, that'll be one of the particular concerns, because if you don't have a local authority delivering, then there's no service delivery taking place. Then there is no, there's no benefits that the local populace in an area is enjoying, and thus they grow disgruntled and they grow, they see the disenfranchisement taking place towards them. They will feel like it's a personal attack against them, even though they voted in the previous local authority year for said local authority in that office. So yeah, discontent will be an issue. It's besides the cash grabbers through the army. It's besides that point. But if you have Helmut, it's, it keeps coming back to various things. Happiness reports. Why are the Finns and the Danes the happiest guys? Well, they can open up a tap and the water is running. Well, they can
access... Oh, I just figured out why the Norwegians are on top of that list.
Oh, now they're on top for this year.
Yeah, they're always in that,
in the top five.
I'm not sure about top five, but...
No, always
them,
the scandals.
Yeah, they're always in the top five.
Yeah.
I know, specifically the Norwegians. I don't know about anyone
else. The lowest ranking one is always Sweden. I don't know why. I don't know what the Swedes do. Maybe. The Norwegians have their sovereign wealth fund. The Danes just made sure that everything in life is sorted for their local population. The Finns just took that step a little bit further, and the Icelandics are just too few. That literally, with one of our local print media platforms, the Icelandics said, yeah, there's no such thing as corruption in Iceland. There is a lot of corruption in your country, Namibia.
I also saw that. But now I just have one question. Are they wrong?
No, they're not, Helmut. Because...
Look, you can get angry, but are they wrong?
Because they're literally throwing... They're literally throwing, using our president's words, and they just turn it into a different, harder ball, you know, like a cricket ball or a hockey ball. Instead of it being a nice little soft, plashy ball, you know, saying, which was with the words, we are too few to be poor. Now they just went and said, okay, let's turn it into a cricket ball or a hockey ball. You know, something severely hard. And now you go like, you have corruption.
Dude, not only do we have corruption, but I feel like our corruption is very cheap, dude. Because...
our corruption is cheap.
Yeah, it's very cheap. Because,
oh, yeah, that is true, eh?
Look at, you know, Donald Trump. Donald Trump got a plane. Is it from... got a 747.
Gold-plated.
Plane. That's custom-made for Donald Trump.
How do you... How do
we asked for a smartphone with two SIM cards. That's the difference.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We...
That's how easy we are to bribe.
An iPhone with two SIM cards.
An investor can come here with KFC and someone will give him a fishing quarters. Now...
which is true. Which is true. You're right, Helmut.
All you just have to do is say, okay. Actually, now it kind of makes sense why it's much easier for a lot of, you know, both your so-called foreign investors to invest in an unstable area.
Mm.
Because, well, where you have a lot of chaos, you don't have a lot of protocol to follow. So you don't have, because you don't have a lot of laws that are regulating that. All you just have to do is be in good books with the captain that's running the whole army, and you're good to go. Oh. And that guy's laws are very flexible, that his main mode of prosecution is execution.
You know, they don't even have what the Soviets had, you know, gulags. Let's just go lock the guy up. We don't want to see his face.
Those guys were something else.
Yeah. They rather want to resort to human rights abuses on epic scales. But yeah, I mean, each one unto their own. But the conversation itself, Helmut, has
on money, African Union, that's going to take forever.
No, but we have to be serious with life, Helmut. We really have to. It's a new phrase I learned just yesterday. Be serious. We literally have to be serious on this continent. Because the money, yes, you can always make the money back.
Yeah.
But for the public sector, or for a multilateral organization like the AU, you have to give reports back to member nations about the various you know, think about like a ministry, where you've got directorates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what the AU have. They've got commissions. So that commission has to report on the money that they just spent for 2025. And to hear, oh, you guys have to actually come and prove to us what you spent the money on last year. We still don't know what you spent the money on. We heard and saw that there were conferences, but what were the deliverables from those conferences?
Yeah, but first of all, we have to find out what projects is the EU running. Apart from silencing of the guns, which fell on its flat, which fell on its face.
It doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it doesn't exist, and we just like, okay, you know what, these guns are gonna go on for. And that meeting, you know, that meeting in DRC, in DC, of the whole agreement, you know, peace deal between Rwanda and DRC. For me, that meeting points to a lot of what's wrong with this continent, and that's. In the very same way that we don't like talking about our involvement in our own enslavement, which we did. We don't like to talk about it, but we did.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, even to this day, you know, call it neocolonialism, economic exploitation by the former colonizers. You can call it whatever you want. We are also contributing to it. Well, when these multinational companies are coming into the country and, you know, especially coming into this war-torn country and operating, you can't tell me they are doing it against our knowledge. We are well aware that these guys are in your country, which is unstable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Helmut.
You are aware of it? Look, when I looked at that negotiation, the way I knew the conflict in DRC was that M23 was this rebel group that none of the two countries wanted to associate with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course, you know, there have been allegations that they are being backed by Rwanda,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not aware of if Rwanda basically admitted to sort of like backing them up militarily. But now, when that peace deal was being made, I'm looking at the DRC representative. And the US was there, and interesting enough, they didn't even ask, like, okay, isn't M23 the problem, causing the problem, the tension between you two? Where's their representative? Which is also a very interesting point, which, because after that, the US president just decided to go and say, you know what, I've brokered a peace deal. Like, okay, I still didn't see the M23 representative. And
what's the unit?
The one from DRC side.
Yeah, the paramilitary from the... Look at me.
They didn't have their representative either. My question is, first of all, why didn't the US ask for the representative from the two paramilitary guys that were supposedly causing the chaos? They were just okay with dealing with there are a lot of questions that are unanswered there.
Well, Hamoud, basically, there's one definite answer. They proved that they were both guilty of using proxies.
Yeah.
So, by bringing the two governments together,
yeah,
the governments agreeing to something,
uh-huh.
which meant the governments were technically confessing that they were the ones
that were fighting the war through proxies.
Yeah. They basically acknowledged through action
uh-huh.
that it was them fighting each other. But you and I, we went through the history of that Eastern DRC situation. Because it literally popped up in 1998, right after the Rwanda genocide.
Yeah.
Because suddenly now, the people living in East DRC are now deemed as persona non grata by the DRC people. And somehow no one is telling, you know, the leadership in that country, hey, dude, you saw what happened right next door to you. How are you not addressing this kind of rhetoric, this kind of conversation, this kind of media coverage regarding calling people subhumans or disrespecting them on other many levels of discriminatory, which are discriminatory in extent,
mm-hmm.
and then trying to chase them back into that country. What makes you think this particular conversation will work? Well, Helmut, what you and I saw from last year was the hatchets in that conversation
mm-hmm.
were never buried.
No, they were not.
The hatchets in that conversation was never buried. So what happens now if the next presidential elections for DRC pops up? And the next political guy who stands up against Tshisekedi, literally against Tshisekedi,
mm-hmm.
does literally what Tshisekedi also did. Not willing to acknowledge that the Banyamulenge are part of the broader DRC national development plan. What happens in such a scenario?
It can easily be construed as just using existing tribal tensions for a whole different endgame.
Mm.
Because it doesn't explain to me why two established nations leaders showed up, or more like sent their representative. First of all, they showed up in Qatar
mm.
to discuss those peace talks, and the Qatari did not ask the important questions here. Like, last time I checked, you guys keep saying you are not fighting. The two paramilitary groups on both sides of your borders are the ones that are causing all the chaos at your border.
Yeah.
Now, if you guys are not officially at war, why am I mediating a deal between you two? The Qatari didn't ask that question. And when that negotiation went to Washington, Washington didn't ask that question. So, the conclusion that I'm just drawing on the very simple, basic understanding that I have of politics is that, these two leaders, like you just pointed out, they practically confessed to using proxies to fight each other.
Yeah.
And the Qatari and the U.S. silence now on asking what is going on here. Where are the representatives of the guys that are supposedly at war? The silence of these two countries raises the question that Sudan filed with regards to the UAE, accusing them of backing up the Rapid Support Force. So, takes us to 2015, Omar al-Bashir, and why this, is it Africa Energy something? This this that gentleman, the Cameroonian business, the Cameroonian billionaire, who well just studied law in the U.S., graduated, started working for the UN in DRC, and realized that. The reason behind this chaos, actually it paints, it brings up the discussion of why a lot of multinationals would want to invest in a war-torn area.
Mm.
Because the first book he wrote after being exposed to the reality of the conflict was, the book I believe is titled, There Are Billions at Stake. He just realized it's not going to be easy to bring this conflict to the end because there are a lot of people making money off of it.
They are, but they unfortunately are. But before we
end
our discussion, we quickly take a short ad break. Velvice University for the 2026 July applications that are now open for the Faculty of Health Sciences for the Postgraduate Diploma in Community Health Nursing Level 8. Admission requirements are as follows for candidates. They must have a recognized nursing qualification at NQF level 7 or higher from any recognized higher learning institution. Candidates must be a registered nurse or midwife with the Nursing Council of Namibia or the Health Professions Council of Namibia. Candidates must have a minimum of 2 years working experience as a nurse or midwife in any health facility, and candidates must write a short essay describing the motivation for pursuing the postgraduate diploma in community health nursing. The qualification duration is 1 year and mode of delivery is full time. For more information, please call 081-403-6406. Velvice University, where everyone is an achiever.
Yeah, African, African Union financing.
Yeah.
That's not getting away anytime soon.
Look, we'll be able to do something.
Yeah, in 100 years.
Yeah, in 100 years, you're right. Yeah, it's just what we've got to look at in terms of a roadmap. There's one thing I realized, Helmut, that is a nice thing that the Europeans or the EU guys have done. They love introducing roadmaps to show you. This is what we're going to do at every step from this public engagement. These are the following steps that we're going to follow. And so far, for example, if you look at the green hydrogen program in Namibia, we've seen those steps. And those steps have been pretty public in some scenarios. And they have brought forward a particular unique stock-taking or transparency angle in terms of you announce something large-scale, so at the same time, the people of the country need to know at every interval what is going to be the next step. Instead of now just announcing, but there's going to be fish quotas, and then silence for 5 years, and then you go find out there are ministers looking for, dual SIM card, smartphones.
Like, look, it's very insulting to a politician, if you ask me, because when Trump was bribed, he was bribed with a multi-million dollar US plane.
Gold-plated.
And thank you.
Keep emphasizing the gold-plated
like,
thing.
Like the, yes, it's a bribe, but the bribe demand is high.
Yeah.
And iPhone with two SIM cards, that's the best you can do.
Helmut, you can't even hide a gold-plated aeroplane. It was so big, it literally shined so much in the sun, you know, that's how bright it shone, that it was a discussion of you either accept it or you accept it.
Look, he accepted it and then thanked them with missiles from Iran. I would never bribe Trump again. That's not a very good way to appreciate a gift. Yeah. Multi-million. Until tomorrow, same time, same place on Eagle FM with yours truly, Helmut and Dwight here on Home Run. Of course, taking over is David with business and economic segment. Yeah, it's going to be a long ride for Africa to basically get where we want to be. Well, and Africans, please, for the love of God, stop praying for miracles. God gave us the resources. We are looking up and praying for miracles. If I was him, I would slap every single one of you, including the prophets, and tell you, guys, dig down. That's where I gave you the resources. It's down there. Get it?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But on that note, guys, stay tuned for David. I hope David has the same energy that we just promoted here through the discussion. But yeah, same time, same place tomorrow, guys. Stay tuned.